You don't build weapons, and this is what concerned Eisenhower, you don't build weapons without finding an excuse to use them. That's the problem. You know, most of the people who work in this area, whether they're uniform, whether they're doing it for the wage, you know, or profit or something, they want to feel they're doing God's work. They want to feel they're saving the country. Nobody wants to feel corrupt. And they buy into the threat inflation. They buy into the military dimension. They buy into scorn for diplomacy. You know, they buy into the strong unilateral Pax Americana unipower vision. And they find reasons to have the weapons. What Eisenhower was warning against was you don't build these things without developing a constituency for war, for militarism, for being tough, Pax Americana and so forth. Reason, pace making does not seem as profitable. And you develop this enormous constituency in every congressional district all over the country. That's the real danger.
That was Robert Scheer, and this is a program by Global Voices for Justice, a nonprofit media organization. I am Lisa Michelle Lovelace. During this 2008 presidential election campaign period, we are bringing you a series of special programs that deal with the most relevant issues that are highly impacted by governmental policies: Middle East, war, military budget, American empire, education, health care, and many more. This program is dedicated to military and military budget. The total U.S. military budget is approximately $630 billion, although some say an all-inclusive estimate could be double that amount. In this program, Robert Scheer discusses how this money is spent and how wasteful projects have siphoned money away from many of the real ills of our society that have been overlooked because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Robert Scheer is a journalist who has built a reputation for strong social and political commentary since he was a war correspondent during Vietnam. In the 1960s, Scheer was editor at Rampart Magazine. In the 1970s, he was a correspondent at the Los Angeles Times, then a columnist from the 1990s until 2006, at which time he became the chief editor of TruthDig.com. Robert Scheer has interviewed every president and presidential contender since the 1960s. Robert Scheer has written many books, including The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq, Playing President, and his recently published book, The Pornography of Power. Robert Scheer spoke in San Diego, California on July 26, 2008, on the topic of his latest book, The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America.
Hi. I want to thank everyone. Frankly, I didn't think I would need to write this book. I thought it'd be totally unnecessary. There's nothing in my book that should be controversial. This is not a plea for socialized medicine, which I would like to write, but I didn't. You know, it's not a plea for worldwide income redistribution, which I would like to write. I didn't. And it's not even a plea for having a federal poverty program, which our last great Democratic president ended in the name of welfare reform, which is a book I could have written, and I didn't write. Once again, I was reduced, as I have been often in my life, of putting my finger in the dike so the whole thing doesn't come apart. And the idea that I had to write about or warn people once again of General Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex is really bizarre. It's almost half a century since he uttered that warning. And he uttered the warning, by the way, when we had a real enemy. You know, whatever you thought about the Cold War, the fact is the Soviets were building some pretty dangerous weapons, and one could make a plausible argument that we had to counter them somehow. There was a certain logic to it. But he, nonetheless, in his farewell address, chose to warn us about this independent military industrial complex that doesn't care about security or anything else, cares about lining its own pockets and has its tentacles in every congressional district. He chose a key moment of tension in the Cold War not to rally us to, you know, greater effort there, but greater vigilance about the Pentagon, about the corporations that feed on the Pentagon. So I didn't think I would have to write this book, and I just want to mention a few things. The first, you know, just like Richard Nixon now seems like a flaming liberal, and, you know, I mean, we have really receded enormously in our life. I mean, Nixon now, you know, God, you know, he came out for a guaranteed annual income. Does anyone remember that? And Moynihan was his domestic counselor. He was very big for starting the Environmental Protection Agency. He made that opening to China. Detente with the Russians all seem like wild policies now. If, you know, anybody advocates negotiation now with Iran, they're suspect. Imagine Nixon went and saw the bloodiest dictators in the world, had drinks with them, and said, we can do business. Right? Everybody forgets. You know, what would happen to a candidate who did that, or a president who did that now? But anyway, another guy who's looking better and better is the first President Bush. Seems, well, first of all, you know, he has a brain. No, I mean, I'm not being sarcastic. I mean, he, you know, how many parents have to go with this? I mean, I have it. I have three wonderful sons. But imagine you have a son who never cracked a book, never thought about a thing, and he turns out to be a two-term president, you know, because he lies better than you do. Okay. So I want to read something that George H.W. Bush said in his 1992 State of the Union address. All right? He said, I mean to speak this evening of the changes that can take place in our country now that we can stop making the sacrifices we had to make when we had an avowed enemy that was a superpower. Now we can look homeward even more and more and move to set right what needs to be set right. For half a century now, the American people have shouldered the burden and paid taxes that were higher than they would have been to support a defense that was bigger than it would have been if imperial communism had never existed. 2 years ago, I began planning cuts in military spending that reflected the changes of the new era. But now this year, with imperial communism gone, that process can be accelerated. The Secretary of Defense recommended these cuts. By 1997, we will have cut defense by 30% since I took office. That's the first President Bush. His Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney. Pre-Halliburton, Dick Cheney. That was the mood in the country. Now, you had neoconservatives around. They were very upset with this President Bush, just as they were very upset with Richard Nixon. Remember, the neoconservative movement started in response to Nixon, because Nixon, despite the irrationality of Vietnam, the deadly irrationality, getting millions of additional people killed, recognized that communism was not internationalist, the boogeyman was not the way it was described, and you could do business with these people, and he was proved right. He went to China and he did the taunt. And the neocons resented it, fought it, and the military-industrial complex fought it every inch of the way. And the first serious opponent of detente was Henry Scoop Jackson. Some of you may remember Scoop Jackson. He was known as the senator from Boeing. And he liked that title. I actually profiled him for Esquire magazine. He thought nothing offensive about it. He represented the state of Washington. Washington was Boeing. This is all before Microsoft. And why not? And who worked for Henry Jackson but Richard Perle, right? Paul Wolfowitz. These others. And they were Democrats then, by the way. A little cautionary note here that I will return to after. So the neocon movement really comes out of that threat inflation. The CIA is underestimating the Russians. Arms control is not working. Nixon's a pinko, so forth, you know. And this movement then continues along. And then, unfortunately for them, the Soviet Union collapses. Unfortunately for Lockheed, unfortunately for Richard Perle, unfortunately for the military-industrial complex. But as Eisenhower warned us, it has a life of its own. It has its tentacles in every congressional district, and they weren't going to go down without a fight. But it was rough going. After Bush won's cuts, Clinton, being a Democrat, was a bit more cautious because they don't want to be called soft on defense, made some cuts, but at least didn't do any wild acceleration. I want to just read a speech in this post-Clinton period, first before 9/11, of what was said at a meeting was given to brass, big ranking officers and civilians at the Pentagon. And it was a note of warning about the dangers faced in the world. The topic today is an adversary that poses a threat, a serious threat to the security of the United States of America. This adversary is one of the world's last bastions of central planning. It governs by dictating five-year plans. From a single capital, it attempts to impose its demands across time zones, continents, oceans, and beyond. With brutal consistency, it stifles free thought and crushes new ideas. It disrupts the defense of the United States and places the lives of men and women in uniform at risk. Perhaps this adversary sounds like the former Soviet Union, but that enemy is gone. Our foes are more subtle and implacable today. You may think I'm describing one of the last decrepit dictators of the world, but their day too is almost past, and they cannot match the strength and size of this adversary. The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy. Now, who gave that speech? Ralph Nader?
Rumsfeld.
Donald Rumsfeld. When did he give it? Come on, that's critical. The day before 9/11. September 10th, 2001. You had a whole Cold War military machine developed, the likes of the world had never seen. The Reaganites credit it with having humbled, destroyed the Soviet Union. You don't have a single credible enemy anywhere that can build any of these kind of toys. Why would you go on building more? They're not totems to be worshipped and danced around. Why do you need them? Why build stealth fighters like the F-22 or stealth bombers, even if their stealthy cover could stay on in the rain, which it didn't for a long time? You know, what are you going to use them for? You know, why more subs? Why this? Why that? You go down the list, all right? 9/11, that was a conventional wisdom. And even though you had the military-industrial complex, even though people wanted these weapons, they really weren't being heard because the logic was so much against them. Then the day after Rumsfeld gave that speech, all logic was thrown out the window, right? The enemy had struck. A war. Instead of treating it as a pathology, deal with it in medical terms, do a surgical procedure, get rid of it, or deal with it in sociological, anthropological terms. What are its roots? Where does it come from? How do you deal? Learn some languages. Learn some history. As opposed to McCain, learn the difference between Sunni and Shiite and so forth, you know. No, I'm serious, you know. I mean, you know, and then there's money you could have spent. You could hire some translators. Get some body armor, you know. But you don't dust off weapons plans for weapons to defeat a Soviet buildup that never occurred. Okay? That's what the F-22 stealth bomb is supposed to penetrate a Soviet anti-air force that never developed. Okay? So to defeat an enemy with an arsenal that you can purchase at Home Depot for a couple of $100, a little tear gas spray, Letterman knives, box cutters, razors. That's the arsenal of the enemy. No subs, no fighter planes, nothing of the sort. So what has happened since 9/11? We now spend more than all of the other nations of the world combined on the military. We spend more in real dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars, than at any time since World War II. More than during the Vietnam War, more than during the Korean War, real dollars, more than when the Soviets were doing whatever they were doing. We spent. All right, then people still say, well, but it's not real big money. Right? You know, why? Okay. It is big money. It's big money because if you talk about the discretionary budget, that's something you should keep in mind, not the overall budget, but take out the mandated Social Security, Medicare, and such. Take them out, because you're not going to touch them. So what you're left with is what's called a discretionary budget. That's what Congress gets to argue about. Almost $6 out of $10 in the discretionary budget goes to the military. So what Congress is debating and fighting about are the $4. That's the reality. It's not chump change. It's the ball game. And whereas spending on the domestic, social, people side of it gets put under a microscope, the military doesn't. Let me just give you a few examples. Joe Lieberman, and by the way, this is a totally bipartisan problem. Don't kid yourself for a minute that it's just the nasty Republicans. Okay? It was pointed out to me by a guy who used to be Chancellor Carter, say he used to be Chancellor of UCLA, but he's a big physicist and worked a lot with weapons and everything. And so a lot of people in the universities do. So the other day, we were at a meeting, we heard General Abizet speak, and we were talking about my book. And Carter said, you know, why are you attacking the B-2 stealth bomber? I said, what do you mean? There's no reason for it. The Cold War is over. It's, you know, supposed to nuke them after they, you know, nuke us. And he said, no, but you don't understand the beauty of the B-2 bomber. I said, what is the beauty of the B? It is a beautiful plane. It's, you know, and he said, the beauty of it is a part is made for that plane in every single congressional district. By design. By design. No one was left out. That's the beauty of that plane. Okay. So we're talking about a bipartisan problem. Okay. So here you got Lieberman, now an independent, but when he was a Democrat, when he was our candidate, when I voted for him, okay, he wanted these subs. Why? Because the Virginia-class sub will first try to save the old subs, now have the Virginia, because they're built in Connecticut, you know, along with Virginia. So 9/11 comes along. We need subs. Now, why do you need subs? How do you use a sub to get bin Laden, who's supposed to be in a cave in a landlocked country? I mean, really, I've been on a lot of talk shows, right-wing shows. I've toured around the country. A lot of people come up to me who work in the military, industrial complex and everything. No one with a straight face can tell me why we need these subs to get terrorists. It doesn't compute, okay? And by the way, then the guy who represents Groton in the House, Courtney, he gets elected by, I think it's 54 votes or 56 votes. That helps the Democrats get control of the House. We're all cheering that on. So Pelosi goes up to him. Murtha goes up to him. They say, what do you need? I need a second sub. 2 a year. Okay. Oh, okay. No problem. We need you. We need your seat. So you got this great constituency and money for building these things that are not needed. Again, it's not chump change. It's around, what, somewhere between $5 and $7 billion a year for the two. They estimate conservatively five. I think they're kidding, but so what? You know what that's equivalent to? The program that Bush vetoed to extend health care to 4 million children who don't have it. That was a $6-7 billion program a year that he said we couldn't afford. They put it under a microscope there. Two subs, piece of cake. Okay? We're not going to question it, right? $12 billion cut Medicare, right? We need to do that. $12 billion doesn't even show up in military spending programs. You know, the F-22 jet fighter that I mentioned before, yet to fly a single combat mission in Iraq or Afghanistan, even if you believe in those wars, cannot be justified as a $65 billion program at minimum. Recently, our Secretary of Defense, Gates, fired the top military and civilian officials in the Air Force. And among the charges, one was that they let that B-52 fly around with wild, loose nukes. But the other one was they were pushing for another 100 F-22s. For what? And the Secretary of Defense objected. He said, we can't have any more of this. Finally, he did something. He's probably not long for the administration, even a lame duck administration. He'll probably be pushed out. But they were pushed out. So these programs have enormous amounts of money connected with them. And as I say, they cannot be in any serious way defended in terms of the war against terror, which is what triggered this. So what do they do when they want to defend these programs? They fall back on an old boogeyman, China. That's what Lieberman does in his speech. That's what Chinese are coming. They're building. Chinese, okay. Now, this is an even wilder argument than invoking the terrorists. Because if there's something that's very clear about the world we live in now, the Chinese communists have become better free market capitalists than us. This is what they live for, all right? And the fact is, they don't control any oil. They know the old-fashioned imperial power thing doesn't pay. We conquered Iraq's oil. It was supposed to pay for the war. Now we're paying through the nose 5-6 times more than what the price of oil was when Bush conquered it. We have to pick up the tab for guarding the oil. We have to guard the shipping lanes, pay all that freight. We get nothing in return. The Chinese don't own any oil. They hardly have any in their own country. What do? They go around like old-fashioned capitalists, and they buy the stuff, futures all over the world. So they're playing a different game, all right? And not only that, but if you think of where what the Chinese threat is, we actually have some documentation on it. I discuss it in my book. And that is the Congress has mandated the Defense Department to assess this danger. And the most recent assessment of it, the 207 report, says it will take China until the end of the decade and longer, most likely, to become a mid-level regional military force. Mid-level regional. Nothing to take on the superpower United States. And it said China's whole military orientation is towards Taiwan. Well, what happened in the last 4 weeks? Anybody notice? A horrible thing for the military-industrial complex. Peace broke out. The whole reason for our presence in the Pacific was wiped out. Why? Because the fellows who left the mainland with Chiang Kai-shek, the Kuomintang, who we used to be able to count on to be the real hardliners, right? won the election, and even their opponents were for better relations with the mainland, but the Kuomintang people, the chairman of the party, right away went to the mainland and said, war is off the table. We're here to make peace. This is the new chapter, all right? Yes, the peace and money, they go together. It's something we've been arguing against these realists. And yet you're absolutely right. It's much more economical and profitable to wage peace than war. We're learning that in Iraq, where we've already spent $1.5 trillion. Not for some arms manufacturers. Not for some. They always make out like bandits, whether it's a French imperialism, Russian imperialism, English imperialism. But the fact is, yes, for the average person, it's not a good deal. But the Chinese, Taiwan is, one of the businessmen of Taiwan represent a major source of investment on the mainland. They're building their second homes, they're finding their second families, and they're sending their children there to improve their Mandarin and mainland. That's the reality. Everyone knows this except us, okay, when we argue for these weapons. So the game has changed fundamentally, fundamentally. And what happened 4 weeks ago Friday, we had the first scheduled direct flights between Taiwan and the mainland. You'd think they'd be cheering here. We don't have to worry about them anymore. Instead, there's doom and gloom in the circles of the military-industrial complex and denial, deep denial. And so for the first time, tourists now go back and forth. And it's interesting. I followed this on the internet in Taiwan because they ran some of my columns and there were a lot of chats and discussions about whether I was too optimistic or not. So I found it interesting. And in the discussion, it turns out the great fear about the Chinese tourists were not that they were going to blow up buildings, right? Not that they were going to steal secrets. No, spit on the sidewalks. Spit on the sidewalks because there's this chauvinistic attitude. They're more country cousins. And whether they were properly coached or whether there's just a fear that should not be acknowledged as anything, but you can't say racist, but anti-mainland, they didn't spit on the sidewalks. And they, in fact, behaved exactly the way the Taiwanese tourists behaved when they landed on the mainland. They headed for exactly the same shops, exactly the same bargains, exactly the same, and taking pictures all the way. So here is this specter of the China taking over the world and everything that just collapsed, and it doesn't inform our discussion. That's why I call my book The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Because you cannot assume the great conspiracy in this country is the one between pundits, politicians, lobbyists, to pretend that adults are watching the store. That what is being discussed is really the thing itself. Okay? It is not. It's not. It's your career. It's your profit. It's your retirement. It's your stock option. It's your reelection. But it's not the security and safety of the United States. That's why Eisenhower gave the speech he did. It has a life of its own. So when they talk about we need these weapons, they will always find a security function, but they're not serious. This China thing is an example. And what are we left with? We're left with borrowing money from the Chinese, which we pay interest on, and we hope to hell they don't cash in their dollars for euros, or we're really in the toilet. That's the way they could destroy our country. And we pay the interest to build weapons, to count the weapons the Chinese have no intention of building. If that is not a truly subversive idea that these people have developed, I don't know what is. So, rather I say this is bipartisan, because it is. The Democratic National Committee attacked John McCain 3 weeks ago. And they attacked him for sending jobs abroad. It concerned the mid-air fuel tanker gas stations in the sky. Did you follow that a little bit? Okay. And because John McCain opposed Boeing's leasing contract deal, then the contract finally ended up with Grumman and the parent of Airbus, and some jobs might go abroad. Now, first of all, why that is the worst thing in the world when we've been, you know, taking jobs from everybody else. I mean, this must be free trade. But leaving that aside, they just attacked him. The Wall Street Journal had a front page, three-column story, never mentioned, you know, really what he did and what the weapons are supposed to do. Why do you need this mid-air fuel tanker? The New York Times had a big spread, never mentioned either one, okay? Now, what did McCain do? And it wasn't McCain alone. It was John Warner, another Republican. And I bring it up only because it's a rare window into a not rare process, an all-too-common process, but this was a rare window, partially out of ego maybe, partially out of his being a stubborn, whatever reason. Not going to go into that. John McCain stood up on the United States Senate and said, somewhere in the middle of the night, a $35 billion, remember, we're talking real money here, $35 billion item was put in to the budget for mid-air refueling tanker leasing. He said, first of all, we could buy those planes outright for and save $6 billion. But why do we need it? Now, why do we need it? Because Boeing was in trouble after 9/11. Commercial flights were down. Let's help Boeing. That's what the lobbyists, the people who are on their payroll, everything say. Let's lease some of those planes, fill them up with gas, and use them to fuel other planes in the sky. Great idea. Okay. McCain objected. He said, we did not have 1 minute of hearing about this. Warner, who was chair of the committee, backed them up. Now, 1 minute. No one brought this before us. No one examined it. And not only is it not a $35 billion spent wisely, it's a program destined to grow to $100 billion. Warner called it the biggest boondoggle he had witnessed in his American government history. $100 billion just out the window, all right, without any hearings, without any testimony, without any evaluation, all right? So McCain now, the Democrats blast him, daring to challenge this wonderful jobs program. As a result of McCain, all right, the CFO of Boeing, the chief financial officer, went to federal prison. The top procurement officer in the Air Force went to federal prison. The CEO of Boeing had to resign. Boeing had to pay back hundreds of millions of dollars. And this was, as Boeing's general counsel, and I have his speech in my book, pointed out in a meeting with top brass on a retreat, one of only six or seven major scandals that were haunting them at that moment. And he said, it's no small wonder that most people we do business with think we're crooks. What part of the conflict of interest legislation don't we understand? This is the Boeing's top lawyer asking this. All right? And the lame defense was, we had to give the top procurement officer in the Air Force a civilian, you know, when she gets through the revolving door, job as a vice president with a lot of big money and everything. Why? Because Lockheed was making an offer. So here you have the two big defense contractors competing for the person who's giving out the most bucks in the Pentagon to these things. I mean, it couldn't be more corrupt. It couldn't be more ugly. Why don't you know about it? Why isn't it in the mass media? Why isn't it on these talking heads? Why isn't it a bigger deal? And how dare the Democrats attack McCain for saving us some money? I mean, it's outrageous. And then what bothers me was I looked at that New York Times story without mentioning what is this thing supposed to do. At least Richard Perle, when he defended the plane, in his column, in an article in the Wall Street Journal, he said, well, we need it for force projection, you know, to go further and so forth and so on. At least he tried to make an argument. Perle did not tell us, the readers of the Wall Street Journal or anyone else, that he had already received $20 million from Boeing for his venture capital firm. This has not in any way hurt his reputation as a talk show person. So those conflicts are just, don't get too agitated about that. That's the norm. That's the norm. But anyway, here in the New York Times, I'm looking at this picture in the New York Times, and they don't explain what this plane is supposed to do, but they have a picture of it, the big gas tank plane, with this rod coming out. You know, it's very sexual, penetrating this sexy stealth B-2 bomber, which we don't make anymore, right? Because there's no logical reason for more of them. So they don't explain. Now, where does that come back to? You remember Dr. Strangelove? Okay. This was Curtis LeMay's fantasy. Curtis LeMay was the guy played by Sterling Hayden. Curtis LeMay didn't believe that just having these land-based nukes would be enough if the Soviets tried to take them out, right? So that's why we had the triad of forces. So you had to have survivable forces on the sea. But that might not be enough. That's why you had to have bombers in the air 24/7 with nukes. So in case they took out our land base and our sea base, and we've taken out now everything they've got, we got these bombers flying around up there in case, say, spot somebody, or even a cockroach, that's surviving somehow in the radioactive debris, they'll bomb them, right? That's what this plane was needed for. Towards that end, we are now going to spend $100 billion, even though we don't have an enemy that's going to take out our land-based, our sea-based, no one in sight, no one can do it. It's absurd. We're actually cooperating in one of the few areas of cooperation with the Russians to try to control these things, you know, to handle them better. So it's nutty on its face.